Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. A few years ago, a Congolese immigrant named Francisca Thielen was living what looked like the American dream in Portland with her American-born husband and their teenage son. She had a decent job, her grown children and grandchildren lived nearby, and thanks to the convenience of cell phones, she was able to stay in pretty close contact with her mom and other relatives back home. But then Francisca began to receive staticky, sporadic, often panicked phone calls from relatives. After years of living in peace and prosperity in Congo, their lives were ripped apart by the sudden violent presence in their community of the Lord's Resistance Army, the bizarre terrorist group run by the self-proclaimed religious leader Joseph Kony, whose followers infiltrated Congo after leaving Uganda. Lisa J. Shannon is a human rights activist and founder of Run for Congo Women. Her new book communicates the kind of suffering wrought by the LRA by distilling it into the experiences of a single innocent family, which would lose more than 24 members to attacks by Kony's followers. The book is called Mama Coco and the 100 Gunmen, an ordinary family's extraordinary tale of love, loss, and survival in Congo. Lisa J. Shannon is in town to speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Lisa, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
What's so remarkable about this story is that it takes these hard-to-fathom headlines that we hear, and frankly not that often in this country, senseless violence, child soldiers, and it brings them all into focus because suddenly we're looking at one family's experiences and maybe their relationships and the way they see each other are not so different from the ways that our own families operate. How did you decide this was the right way to try to communicate this story to an American audience?
Well, you know, that is such an interesting question and absolutely the intention with the book. I've written one other book about Congo, A Thousand Sisters, and I had gone to Congo and interviewed hundreds of women who had lived through all kinds of militia attacks and that kind of thing. When I got home and reviewed a lot of the video footage I had of those interviews, I realized that I had almost exclusively asked them about how they had been impacted by the war, but I asked almost nothing about who they were outside of the war. Mm. Often I didn't even ask the names of family members who had died, and it really haunted me. I felt like I had missed something and potentially something big. And it got me really reflecting on our narratives about Congo, the way we tend to think of Congo and the way it's talked about in the news, and how that actually may play a fairly strong function in allowing the violence to continue. And so as I thought about that and then had a very close friend who started going through this, she was a neighbor of mine and a volunteer for Run for Congo Women. She had invited me to her home many times, and we'd had tea. She'd pulled out photo albums from home and showed me all these beautiful photographs of her family and lush flower gardens and just a very different picture of Congo than I had had, even having been there. And she would encourage me to come visit with her, to come see what she termed the real Congo. For me at the time, you know, Congo was the compelling part was the red hot emergency, you know, people needing help. And as someone who was concerned, trying to do everything that I could for Congolese women. But as I started reflecting on some of the way I had been approaching that, I recognized I was missing something there. And so as she started getting calls from home, the interest in going was not just to find out what had happened to her family, which has been significant with Kony's LRA having moved in, but also to kind of explore that real Congo through the lens of one family. And it turned out to look quite a bit different than any picture I had had of Congo. And in my head, it actually radically changed the way I think about the country, having been there and spent a lot of time just talking with them, not only about the impact, but also, you know, who was her mother when she was 12 years old? And how did her parents fall in love? How did Francisca fall in love with her husband? And all of those dynamics. So the violence in the context of people's full lives, as opposed to looking at other human beings sort of strictly through the lens of violence, which I think is often the way Congo is talked about.
Yeah, it's easy to do that because the situation can be so wretched.
But, yeah.
I was so touched when, you know, we do hear about her family, her parents and their relationship, and it was very sweet. She grew up feeling like a princess.
Yeah, you know, it was so interesting, you know, talking with her about her earliest memories. You know, her father worked at the general store, and so she would sit in the general store watching people come in and out, you know, women cleaning coffee beans and singing on the front porch, and watching independence through the eyes of a four-year-old, you know, just her friends, you know, sons of the Greeks speeding by in cars, and then her father deciding to build his own plantation, and them sort of building their own little empire on their coffee plantation and running around in fields climbing fruit trees and having harvest festivals. And she describes it as a paradise. When she talks about Congo, the first thing she'll say is paradise. And that is not typically the way it's talked about here, but for her, that's what it was. So really try to explore a lot of that in the book.
But even while she was a schoolgirl, there is this great hope from independence, and then things go awry very quickly. And then in the schoolyard, these children were forced to witness things that I wouldn't let my kids watch on TV.
Yeah. So things were going quite well with her family. They had built this coffee plantation. Her father built his own store. They had a general store. And then the Simba moved in. And it's written in the book very much through her perspective. So she was about 8 years old when this happened. They called all the school children to the flagpole at the center of town and killed one of her friend's fathers in front of everyone. And the kids were horrified. She threw up. And the family ran after that because the Simba were really after anyone who was perceived to be affiliated with colonialists. And because her father had worked for the general store, worked for white people, that he was really a target, and he had built up some affluence that way. So the family had to run, and they had to hide basically in the forest for months. Although it was quite magical the way she described it, because once they left the main road, they're walking through these elephant grasses that are taller than her father, out as long, you know, just for an 8 year old, an endless time through forests and fields, until the family wanders into this grove of mango trees that are planted in a perfect circle in the middle of the forest. And so for her, it was just completely magical. I mean, she said, of course, it obviously used to be a plantation of some kind, because mango trees don't plant themselves in a circle in the forest, as she put it. But for her, you know, coming together as a family and everyone kind of camping for months in the forest was a very joyful memory, where she felt like a lot of healing took place. She was able to kind of let go of some of those traumatic images she had been exposed to and just cocoon, you know, sing songs, tell stories. It was really about the connection between people and the connection with the land as well, that was very healing for her. And that's something they really had at that time. You know, as she put it, the bush was our bank. Like, they went out there and found fish and peanuts and had no problem eating and that kind of thing. And the more recent violence has looked very, very different than that. But for her, it was that sense of community and family that was very healing at that time.
And then when they finally felt it was safe to go back to town, they returned but had effectively lost everything that they had built. Her parents had this little business, and it was gone.
Gone, yeah. And her father was very disciplined. I mean, she talked about how the mattresses they had were taken, and instead of going out and buying mattresses with what little they had, they slept on palm leaves while he rebuilt the business, because it was, you know, he had his eyes on the long term and wanting to build financial stability. But even in the face of all of that, the way she talks about Mama Coco as someone who was just meticulously clean, like, you know, braided her hair every day and would, you know, make the girls bathe twice a day, and everything was neatly pressed and very, very well cared for. She would hand make dresses for Francisca and that kind of thing. So the family was very resilient, and they were able to rebuild and build a coffee plantation that was very successful, you know, for that part of the world, and really build a sense of pride and identity in who they were as a family and their community.
So the way Francisca got to the U.S. to live here is that she fell in love with a Peace Corps volunteer who initially she thought she wanted nothing to do with, I guess.
Yeah, so it's funny. The story of them meeting, because she was assigned the task of greeting him and waited up late. He came in quite late at night, and finally, in the blare of the car's headlights, he emerges from the car, and he has long hair, so she blurts out, "Bonjour, mademoiselle." And he's like, "Hey, wait, I'm a man." And she talked a lot about how she really didn't like white men, because in Congo at that time, often they would sit, you know, in offices with their fancy shirts and that kind of thing, kind of ordering people around.
Yeah.
Whereas Kevin was someone who would get out into the trenches with his crew and work all day on projects. And she ran across him and offered him lunch. And he refused because he said, "Why would I eat lunch when my guys can't eat lunch?" And from that point forward, he would bring them like peanuts and donuts and that kind of thing. And they would all eat together. So I think she was really impressed at how respectful he was, he admired her very much too, because she was a teacher and kind of a leader and outspoken and all of that. So yes, they fell in love and they had a couple of kids, and you know, their intention was to stay in Africa forever. So they had quite a dream there, you know, and I loved hearing the story of their wedding, where they played all kinds of Congolese music mixed with Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Not too many ceremonies like that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But they ultimately, for economic reasons, mostly returned to the United States?
Well, eventually they returned to the U.S. so Kevin could go back to school and get an engineering degree. And they were planning on moving back to Africa. And he got his very first job in Rwanda in 1994. Hmm. And so they moved there. They had a beautiful place on a lake close to Congo. And the day their cargo container arrived with all of their things was the day the Rwandan genocide began. And so they had to escape. You know, certainly neighbors were killed and that kind of thing. And once they were over in Congo, it took a bit to figure out what to do, but ultimately they ended up taking a family vote, and Kevin was the only vote for staying in Africa. Francisca and her kids all voted to stay in the U.S. So they've lived here permanently since then.
Your dedication to Congo starts in a really unlikely way. Of all things, you turned on the TV one afternoon and saw the Oprah Winfrey Show.
Yeah, you know, it was right before my 30th birthday, shockingly 10 years ago. I saw this episode where it was just a 20-minute report on violence against women in the Congo. So, you know, I was just moved. Women for Women International was on the show, and they had a program supporting women-to-women sponsorship. So you could send women letters and relate to them as sisters, basically. So I decided to do a 30-mile trail run to raise 30 sponsorships for women. That was how the work sort of started. And from there, it grew. You know, at the time in 2005, really, no one was talking about Congo. I mean, if anyone ran a national news story on Congo, I would get contacted by like 20 friends because it was an event.
Wow.
You know? And so my intention was just to try to raise awareness. And the dream was that there would be some kind of movement for Congo. But it really did start as simply as the Oprah Show, and I didn't have any background in this kind of thing. I really stumbled into it. I had never been an activist, never done any fundraising before, never done any public speaking. I was a super wimpy runner, and it was a 30-mile trail run I was doing. So I was making it up from scratch, but just because I cared. And it seemed to grow, because I think that when people hear about stuff like this, often people care quite a bit and they want to find some simple thing that they can do. And the run was a great starting place for that. In fact, the second year, one of the 10 other runs that took place was a woman in Texas, Tracy Dennis, who did about a 10-mile run here. She was, you know, working out, doing her training runs in 110-degree heat. And that's how the movement started, just with a few other people deciding to join in. And then it sort of grew from there.
We're speaking this hour with human rights activist Lisa J. Shannon. She's founder of Run for Congo Women and author of the new book Mama Coco and the 100 Gunmen, an ordinary family's extraordinary tale of love, loss, and survival in Congo. She's down to speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with human rights activist Lisa J. Shannon. Her new book is called Mama Coco and the 100 Gunmen, an ordinary family's extraordinary tale of love, loss, and survival in Congo. She's in town to speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. So, Lisa, you and Francisca had talked for years about going to Congo. Around the time you decided to actually make this trip happen, she started getting these phone calls.
Yeah, and actually, just about a week before we were supposed to go, she got a call that there had been an attack in the town of Dungu. So her family was in this town, but it was considered secure because you have the United Nations, the Congolese army there, but the LRA walked right past the UN base, right past the Congolese army, and ended up murdering a bunch of people a mile from her mother's home where we were supposed to stay. And so that was actually the first time I've ever thought about canceling a trip where it's felt like, okay, this is potentially beyond sort of the danger threshold.
Yeah.
But, you know, for Francisca, this was her family, and they were, you know, sleeping in front of the UN compound, you know, and we needed to know if they were okay. And I could tell when I talked with her this sort of anxiety in her voice that I might cancel, and we just felt like we needed to do it. So we decided to go. And, there were security issues when we were there, certainly. But because it was so driven by her family connections, we felt it was worth it.
The thing you don't go into in the book until like the appendix and stuff is the reason all this is happening. It just feels completely random and senseless. And I sort of liked that because that's clearly how it feels to the victims of this violence. Like,
right. It
doesn't really matter what these warlords are after. It matters what they're doing to people.
Well, that was certainly the intention, really trying to write about the violence from the perspective of a family who's living through it, as opposed to the broader kind of geopolitical landscape. Because it does seem not just overwhelming in terms of the violence, but there's just the enormous frustration over the lack of response. Like, people on the ground just couldn't understand why, the UN wouldn't intervene if there was an attack happening. Why the UN wouldn't send someone to pick up an LRA defector who was ready to leave the militia.
Why didn't they do those things?
You know, that's a really good question. And this is something, it turned out to be a really important piece of Francisca's family story, because her cousin, Roger, was called upon by the local priests to take an LRA defector in. He showed up one day and the priests were calling district administrators in the UN asking them to come and pick them up, and they just wouldn't do it because they said they were, like, busy with other stuff. And so he didn't want to do it. He'd done it before and had trouble even getting reimbursed for gas money. But he was asked to, and from his perspective, you know, he was a member of the PTA. He was a responsible member of the community. You do what you're asked to do. So the LRA defector gets on the back of his bike. They drive 1 mile down the road into the middle of an ambush. And this is the first major LRA attack that's happened. So they had just abducted maybe 60 kids from the local school, and he was murdered.
And Roger was murdered.
Roger was murdered. They continued on to the mission down the road, but Roger's family, while everyone started running, Roger's family stayed to bury him on the coffee plantation. And this ended up proving a really hauntingly fatal mistake, because it was just long enough that the LRA ended up catching many, many more members of the family. If the United Nations had come to pick up that defector, they would have been on the ground in the middle of that attack, and they could have protected people. So when I talked to the parish priest, an Italian man who had been in the region for more than 30 years, do you blame the UN for what happened? I mean, without pause, he said yes. So there's that frustration, like, how could you put this off on people? And if there are so few LRA to begin with, if you want to defect, how is that process? How is it that that process isn't being supported with everything we have? Because it could prevent the violence in the first place.
Lisa, if there are so few, and this is many accounts say that there aren't that many LRA members active in Congo right now, and yet they are, you know, really responsible for a great deal of carnage. How is this small number of people able to carry out violence on such a broad scale?
Well, first of all, there are very few fighters that are ideologically driven. So the title of the book, Mama Coco and the 100 Gunmen, is referring to the roughly 100 or so fighters who were there for ideological reasons. What they do is abduct children, and they traumatize the children, teach them, train them to kill.
Sometimes with the permission of their parents, we should say. These kids are handed over.
Yeah, yeah. And so they are trained to kill, and then they feel they'll be murdered. If they try to leave, they'll be killed, so they won't. But they don't want to be there. On the other side of it, you wonder, well, how can so few people sort of control that sort of territory? Well, what they'll do, for instance, you'll hear about massacres where they would kill, you know, 120 people and leave one survivor so that the survivor could report back to everyone else how horrific the violence was, so they could control through that kind of terror. And this is actually something that several militias, the FDLR in the Kivus, use the same sort of tactics. And I think this is really when people talk about rape as a weapon of war, what they're really talking about. You know, low-tech warfare is about instilling terror in people, so people are too scared to even go out and farm. And this is, you know, that has actually resulted in exponentially more deaths because people are too scared to go farm, and then there's no food. Food prices go up exponentially, and then you have a lot of deaths that way as well. So it's low-tech warfare, and terror is sort of the currency there, you know.
So you get to the city of Dungu, and this is where Francisca's from, and sort of bizarrely, when you first arrive, people are just trying to extend you a welcome, and so they prepare a meal, and there's like some small talk, and why aren't you married if you're 35 or whatever.
Yeah.
and then an uncle in the family is like done with the small talk because something horrible has just happened.
Yeah. Yeah, Papa Alexander, who ends up becoming just a major character in the book and figure in our trip there, wants to talk about what's happened. And Francisca just isn't ready. She just wants home to still be home. And I think she knows that the minute she starts listening to these stories, it's going to really strip away her whole concept of what home is, and it was going to mean letting in all of that pain. And so there was a real ambivalence on her part to open that up. And in that instance, she tried to shut the conversation down. But then people turned to talking about the attack that had happened just the week before, a mile from Mama Coco's house. And, you know, they told us the story of what happened. As I mentioned, they killed people, including, an aunt who they shot at very close range. They were about to kill her daughter, and she ran toward the militia and was like, please kill me instead. And so they just turned their gun on her and shot her in the chest. She actually lived. Another woman who turned out to be Francisca's cousin grabbed her baby and was running and shot in the back. She fell down, dragged herself over to the bushes to hide, sort of holding her son. And she bled to death that night. And in the morning, they found her baby still nursing from her dead body. And this was Francisca's cousin. So that moment is the moment where it all starts to really come in for Francisca. And it's clear that there's just not going to be a way for her to hold back the tidal wave. And I think that was a balance for us the whole time, because there was a piece of her that just wanted to be with the family. And on the other hand, feeling like we had gone there to understand what had happened so that she could come back and be a voice here for people to engage more and for us to be able to share the story. So that was a constant tension while, during our time there.
It seems like in the abstract, she might have thought, of course, I can do this and it'll be in service to the greater good. And I can act. She was acting as your translator in many cases.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you were going to learn anything, it had to be through her as a language conduit. And it makes sense that she got there and it didn't mean the same. And I wonder if that, how that affected your relationship to her when you realized it would be causing her great pain to ask her to do what you had agreed she would do in the first place.
You know, it was really hard. I tend to be, every time I've gone to Congo prior to that trip, very mission focused when I'm there. You know, we are here because the stakes are high and we've got to be able to share these stories. And trying to balance that against what it does to people when you ask them to share these stories. And I think it was problematic on two fronts. One was the tension Francisca felt. And the other was the shifting relationship the family had with sharing their story. So it began with Papa Alexander frustrated with us because we hadn't sat down with him and we hadn't asked him. But by the end, it brought up so much emotion for him to have to tell these stories that even saying something to him like, I'm so sorry this happened, like when you'd see he was sort of getting close to the edge, like it's just so many people to lose in one day, and have him just completely break down. But then carry a lot of resentment toward not just me, but Francisca for having asked the questions in the first place. And what do you do with that? You know, I mean, obviously be respectful if someone doesn't want to talk, but temporarily, I believe they're in a different place with it now. You know, I think Francisca felt like something was really damaged in her relationship with her uncle through that process, because even when we managed to talk about lighter topics, we thought, okay, we'll just handle this differently, give it some time, circle around. You know, in our final interview with him, we'd finally gotten him to warm up again, and then an envelope was delivered in the middle of the interview, and we don't know what it is. We just know that the Italian priest has stopped by, and we pull out these photos, and it's photos of his son Roger with the LRA on the back of the bike about to ride into the middle of that ambush. So it turns out to be the last photos ever taken of Roger, and he's never seen them before. So he obviously wanted to see what we were looking at, but it just, something broke in that moment when Francisca tried to reach out to him after that. It just, you know, when people are dealing with that level of trauma, if you open it up, it just can become really uncontained. And I think it was just very delicate. And I try to be really honest about that in the book, about where some of those tensions were and how you try to navigate your way through that.
You went to visit a children's hospital ward, and you met a little boy there who really struck you. And it turned out to be the boy who was left for dead with his mother.
Yeah, Irite. So Irite, you know, when I met him, had been in the hospital for a couple of weeks, and he was quite limp and just not able to rally. And it's not that during the attack he was injured per se, but people just kept saying he was cold. It was so cold that night, and that something was just drained out of him. And so I thought, I found him by himself one day, and I picked him up, and he sort of rested his head on my shoulder, and I was like, oh no, I'm so sunk. He's just the sweetest little guy. And so I just started borrowing him so Francisca could have time with her family. I would just start borrowing him and showing him like little videos of my cats on my phone, or, you know, feeding him pineapple or whatever. And we got to be very good friends and spent a lot of time together. When we were there, I dreamed about adopting him, but it wasn't the right thing. You know, he
but
had
you more than like you really were making plans. You thought, what if this could be a possibility?
Yeah, I really did explore it. Like, is there any way? At this point, you know, I turned 35 during that trip, mm-hmm. and I had been an activist for 5 years. And financially, there's just no way I would pass a home study being a freelance activist and that sort of thing. So, but then I thought, okay, well, what if I could be a godmother? Right, that could be a way to do it. But I'm not Catholic, and he. You know, we talked to priests, and he's the third born of unmarried parents. So there were reasons that they just wouldn't allow that. And so it was one of those things where I think if I have regret about anything in all of my time working on issues in Congo, I have regret about that moment, because I feel like it's so easy to tell yourself, okay, it's not my role. I'm getting signals. It's not my role to really intervene or do anything here. I feel like I could have done more. I feel like with him, I could have figured out a way to send support. I could have figured it out, and I didn't. I thought, okay, I have that thing that everybody has where you just have doubt, like this isn't my role. And so I stepped back and lost touch, and then, you know, a couple of years later learned that he died. That because of food shortages in the area, he had become very anemic, and by the time he got to the hospital, it was too late. And he passed away, and I felt like, you know, as I said, that's just the one thing that I feel like as an activist. You know, you can get a lot of things right, but when you form that personal connection with someone, it becomes something else entirely. So,
you met mothers who had lost so many children that they would just hold up the number of fingers when asked this question. And one thing that struck you that I think is probably common to a lot of Western people is we assume if within particular societies this is such a common thing that somehow they must have found a way to make it less of a strike at one's emotional core.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem that they're any less broken by the deaths of their children than mothers anywhere.
That's right. I mean, the day that I met Arete in the hospital, there was another cousin of Francisca's right across the row, and he was quite ill and ended up dying the next week. So we attended that funeral, and that was the moment that clicked for me. That here you have a 1-year-old who's died, and they were having a family funeral, and everyone was just wailing and singing and just in very, very deep grief about it. And I realized, like, how is it that I've thought all these years that somehow that would land easier because it's more common? Of course it feels the same way. And it's true, you know, in Congo, there were very few women that I met in Congo who had not had children die. Almost all of them had children die, and often it was 2 or 3 or 4. One woman who I had sponsored through Run for Congo Women had 10 children die. Hmm. So just incredibly common, but no less painful.
We're speaking this hour with Lisa J. Shannon. She's a human rights activist and founder of Run for Congo Women. Her new book is called Mama Coco and the 100 Gunmen, an ordinary family's extraordinary tale of love, loss, and survival in Congo. She's in town to speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Lisa J. Shannon, a human rights activist whose new book is called Mama Coco and the 100 Gunmen. She's in town to speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Joseph Kony is still out there somewhere.
He is, and in fact, folks have a pretty good sense of where he is. He's very likely in a little pocket of Sudan, and unfortunately, the African Union and U.S. Special Forces who are over there don't have permission to enter the area. But I think it's a place where some diplomatic pressure might make a really big difference, because this is what, you know, there are a lot of militias in Congo where you could say, okay, well, you get that guy, but then they'll just be more.
Right. Because
Kony is a cult leader, getting him and taking him to the International Criminal Court stands a very good chance of ending the LRA once and for all. So it's really important that he's captured. And since we have a pretty strong sense of where he is, it feels like that's an area of pressure could make a pretty big difference.
Is there any even twisted logic to the kinds of things that I hesitate to use the word preaches, because I just can't, I can't give credence to the idea that he's a a man of God, as he claims mm-hmm. to be. But mm-hmm. but is there something about what he says that you can understand why that appeals to the small core of people who are ideologically motivated to follow him?
I wish I could say I understood it. I don't. I mean, look, he would say his objective is to take over the government of Uganda and rule it by the Ten Commandments. What he's done is so far disconnected from that I find it very difficult to track. But I think that if you look at evil acts or this kind of just horrific violence, it's always motivated by someone believing they have a positive intention for something. No one does these things believing they are doing evil things. Like, for instance, almost every militia in Congo believes itself to be a local defense force, right? They believe themselves. It's this thing that this sort of offending from the victim's position that happens a lot. I think if you look at a lot of the violence that takes place, you know, all over the world, that tends to be the position. It's how the Rwandan genocide took place, is where a lot of militias in Congo are coming from. I think if you really drill down into it, you might end up there. But it's been so heavily sort of thwarted with his tactics that it's impossible to really negotiate or take any piece of his objective all that seriously.
What's the effect on the children who have grown up knowing nothing but this kind of violence and terrorization?
You know, that is a really tough question, and I think we saw that in Dungu, most specifically through Francisca's nephew, Niankangba, who was abducted when he was about 12. And he had come back and tried to integrate back with the family, and people would try to joke around with him, and he'd be like, "Don't joke with me. I know how to kill people. It's not a problem to kill." Mm. He pounced on kids in the family with a machete. And so he's been moved along, but had a really hard time staying anywhere for very long because the trauma is just so deep. And he was when I interviewed him, he talked about murdering people with axes and participating in massacres and that kind of thing.
How chilling is it to hear that from a 12-year-old?
Pretty chilling. I mean, sometimes you sit down with kids, and I've sat down with a lot of child soldiers, and I've done this in the Kivus as well as in Dungu. Sometimes you can see there's a spark there and there's a hunger to figure this out, even if they know they're really wrestling with it. And sometimes it feels like that light has just kind of gone out. Mm. And when I'm talking with them, I'm always looking for some kind of entry point, like, and with this, with Niankangba, I offered for him, you know, could we pay for school? Can I get you a soccer ball? Like, is there anything we can do? And he just wasn't interested. In his case, you know, he knew he was there the day his father was Roger. Mm-hmm. And he was there when they buried Roger. And he was abducted shortly thereafter. And when he was in the militia, he thought about nothing but getting back to see his mom again, because he was always someone who was a little helper. You know, he was always helping out with stuff, and he participated in church a lot with her. So he was looking forward to seeing the priests and would think about her. And when he finally escaped, which was motivated by feeling he may never see her again, he escaped. Then he finally made it to Dungu and learned she had died. And I think there was something about that for him. Like, he probably had that thread of hope until he realized she had died too, that something was lost. But, you know, in South Kivu, I actually did sit down with a kid who was born in he was 1 year old during the Rwandan genocide and immediately child of genocidaire, the people who carried out that genocide, and they reformed a militia. He was 17 when I talked to him, and he had grown up only in the forest, only in a militia. And yet he still ran away, like knowing that they'd probably try to kill him if they saw him trying to run away. So there was something in him that knew there was something better out there, you know, and feeling hungry for it. I mean, the surprise really has been that if these kids have a chance to talk to someone who's a relative, who says, "You're welcome to come home. We know it's not your fault. We'll work with you," that often they are more than happy to leave and go try to rebuild a life. So there's something in there, no matter how bad it is, that people seem to really cling on to.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jack in Euless. Hello, Jack. Jack, are you with us?
Yes.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hello?
Hello, go right ahead, Jack.
Yeah, I'm listening.
Oh, yes. Jack, I'm so sorry. We can't hear you very well. What did you want to make a statement? Did you want to ask a question?
Well, I was just going to make a comment that, you know, because I know the story of Congo is a long story, very sad, but it don't get the attention it should because just the way they react stories around here in the U.S. But there is more tragic stories than the ones you go with right now. And it just suddenly the situation can't be so ignored. You know, you got about 60 million people living in all kind of a political problem. But very rare I hear about it on NPR mostly, because this is NPR all the time.
Right. Jack, thank you so much for your call. It was a little hard to hear there, but I think maybe the point of what Jack was saying was that we don't hear these stories very often. They're not in a lot of places, and not to toot the horn of NPR, but at least, you know, we have people there trying to tell these stories, but they're not daily headlines.
That's right. And just to give a little bit of context for folks who aren't familiar, you know, more than 5.4 million people are thought to have died in the conflict in eastern Congo, making it the deadliest war since World War II. So really extreme violence, and one, as I mentioned, very rarely covered. A little bit more coverage now than there was 10 years ago. But, you know, it's just very extreme. And for me, I've had to really think about why is it Anyone who is an activist working on Congo or who takes any time to look at the situation at all has to face this question: why does no one seem to care about this? If there's this extreme violence, what is it that stops it being covered as a news story or people trying to engage in doing something? You know, and I've grown to feel there may be something in story structure and stereotype around Congo. So if you look at a basic around storytelling, it's that human beings love stories about change, transformation. And it could be from better to worse or worse to better. That doesn't matter as much as the change. But if we look at what our before snapshot is of Congo in the West, it tends to be sort of like Joseph Conrad, Heart of Darkness, you know, severed limbs, dark, mysterious place where bad things happen. And then if you look at some of the present violence, if you just look at those two data points, it looks like it's static, like nothing has changed. What people don't tend to question is whether or not that first data point, first of all, is accurate, and two, has it been interrupted over time? Is Congo more than that? And so what I think happens is that in a lot of ways, the violence has been normalized before it's even happened. And so we meet this kind of violence with lukewarm interventions. And the expectation of violence ends up leading to the manifestation or metastasis of the violence in a very direct way that's related to how we tell stories. So, for instance, you know, when I first started this work, I talked with an Associated Press reporter who had been stationed at the London office in the early 2000s when the war in the eastern Congo was really at its height. And he said that Congo was synonymous with African conflict we won't cover, that it was just understood. Any story on Congo wasn't going to go out over the wire, you know. And I certainly was curious why, and he said, because it's widely understood that Americans don't have room in their psyches for more than one international conflict.
Wow, is that seriously what you heard?
This is seriously what someone who was a senior person at the Associated Press told me in front of other people. and so... I just think there's a very interesting kind of compassion curating that happens in the media. And there are always some folks who will talk about this stuff, like NPR has been great. Public radio has been great. Nicholas Kristof writes about this in The New York Times a lot. So we have voices that are raising these issues. But depending on who's telling the story and the way it's told, the idea is, how is it news if nothing's changed? News is about what's new, right? So if we think it's always been this way and these people kind of do this stuff to each other, that kind of racist underpinning, then it's not newsworthy to say, oh, yeah, there they are. It's sad, but it's sort of who they are, right? And I think that has a lot to do with it, you know, and that's tough to say because I'd like to say that it's strictly a question of policy, but policy is prioritized based on what people are interested in. My experience, though, has been when people learn about Congo, they actually do want to engage. Like, people care, you know, if they're given the chance to care, right? So I think those are some things we should look at, and it was a big piece of my motivation in writing this book, telling a not ignoring the violence. We can't not talk about the violence, but telling it in a fuller context. And if you tell more of a whole story and a human story, does that make it more approachable in some ways, you know?
You're also a photographer. I wonder how you balance, you know, decisions about telling a story in prose or telling it through images.
Well, I owned a stock photography production company.
Okay.
My partner was a photographer. I sometimes took the pictures. But that was a very different world. And I think talk about contrast. Like, I would my job was basically taking pretty perfect models out to, you know, fields with green grass and blue skies and photoshopping things to look more perfect. Mm-hmm. So that kind of image of happiness versus, you know, I think for me, you know, when I went to Congo the first time, I went with a video camera. I was thinking about a documentary, but I felt like some of the more profound pieces of what happened didn't happen on camera, that it was not only about Congolese people, but the sort of transformation that we go through when we're able to open our hearts and really engage with people and feel empathy and what that does to us. And you can't really capture that in a still photo, or a documentary. So I think that's why I ended up moving more toward writing, because I felt like I could capture that and ask some of the questions that I didn't know how to capture in imagery.
Is money the best way for us to make an impact, a beneficial impact in a place like Congo?
Strategically placed money can have an enormous impact, but I think there are a lot of other things that we can do. I think, one, always letting the U.S. government know that it's a priority to us, that they have a coordinated strategy. So in 2010, for instance, we gave Congo $2 billion between piecemeal sort of programs that weren't coordinated at all. And in some ways, you know, that can actually reinforce some of the problems there. So, for instance, right now, huge issue in Congo is the elections. You know, Kabila, President Kabila, won the election in 2006. It was the first democratic elections they've had in 40 years. And people felt really good about that. I was there in 2007. People were excited about having voted. It was a transparent process. In 2011, the elections were widely regarded as fraudulent. And the international community basically shrugged. And that's a problem, because when you talk about a leader like Kabila, who has shown very little interest in the well-being of Congolese people through his time as president, it's sending a really powerful message that he's not responsible to them, that he doesn't have to answer to anyone. For a country at the place Congo is in its history, that's a very dangerous message to send to leadership. So technically, in 2016, the Constitution of Congo says his term's up, he needs to move on. But he's already started making a lot of gestures toward not wanting to move on. I think investing in transparent elections so that there's a sense of Congolese ownership in solutions for themselves is absolutely key. That's a place we can make a really big difference. I think reaching out to individuals is very, very important. And donations make a big difference, too, if they're given to folks who are really building up Congolese capacity and supporting Congolese leaders.
Lisa J. Shannon is a human rights activist who founded Run for Congo Women. Her new book is called Mama Coco and the 100 Gunmen. She'll speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Lisa, thank you so much for sharing these stories with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Lindsay Connect produced today's show. The engineer is Shelley Canavy. We had help on the phones from Christina Martinez. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.